Hello and welcome to the Middle East Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinier, host of the Middle East and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. We've discussed the Tajik government's repression toward various groups in Tajikistan many times on the Middle East Podcast as the situation in the country has worsened. But in 2022, Tajik authorities have reached new depths in their pursuit of perceived opponents. Scores of people have been imprisoned, and they represent a broad spectrum of Tajik society. Journalists and bloggers, activists, lawyers, religious figures, ethnic Khmeris, and members of the political opposition. And there's been a brief war with Kyrgyzstan on Tajikistan's northern border, and a rocket attack from Afghanistan on Tajikistan's southern border by militants of the Islamic State of Khorasan. So what is going on in Tajikistan this year? To discuss all this, I am joined by Selim John Ayob, the director of RFARL's Tajik service, known locally as Azadi, Edward Lemon, president of the Washington-based Oxa Society and research assistant professor at the Bush School of Government and Public Service, Texas A&M University in Washington, D.C., and Nick Lewis, Central Asia and Caucasus correspondent at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you all for joining me today. We're going to start out with kind of a look at the big picture, and then we'll focus in on various aspects of the problem in Tajikistan, of the problems in Tajikistan. Selim John, you've been reporting on Tajikistan for more than three decades. Except for the 1992-1997 civil war, do you ever remember a time when there was so much going on in Tajikistan in such a short span of time?
No, the answer is no. It's really a kind of extraordinary situation. There were some detentions, some pressure in the past, let's say two decades, but not like today. So some colleagues are calling it a war against journalists and bloggers. There was never a time in Tajik history then more than this number of journalists were detained and sentenced to up to 10 years as Dalir Imamali, just for nothing, just for telling the truth, just for raising social issues, even not going deeply into politics or other, special sensitive zones of the government policies. Yes, the situation is awful.
Okay, thank you for giving us the overview of that. And Nick, Selim John was just talking about journalists, and I know that you've been following the plight of the media in Tajikistan. Can you explain to the audience what's been happening there in recent months?
Sure. Well, obviously, a lot has been going on. We've had since May, at least six or seven journalists and bloggers who could be considered to work as journalists who have been detained, and just recently... As everybody knows, we've had a 10-year sentence handed down to Dalair Imamali. Shortly before this, his colleague Abdullah Gurbati received a 7.5-year sentence. Just a month ago, a retired journalist and blogger, Mohammed Sultan, received a 7-year sentence. And we still have four others who are currently on trial, facing likely long prison terms, including the Pamiri journalist, Ofak Hanim Mohamed Shoaiva, who prosecutors have asked 25 years in prison for her. So we can expect some other serious prison terms to be announced very soon, I think.
Okay, thank you. Grim news indeed. Edward, we are going to talk more about journalists also in this, but the Tajik government is known for its use of transnational repression. And we've seen Tajik citizens forcibly return to Tajikistan many times in the past, but this year it seems to be happening more frequently and involves people mainly from Tajikistan's eastern Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast. Can you walk us through a little bit about the use, the Tajik government getting its citizens extradited, deported from other countries this year?
Yes, Bruce, as you say, you know, when we've had these crackdowns, intense periods of crackdowns in Tajikistan, historically we have seen an uptick in Tajikistan reaching overseas to target opponents or even just members of, in this case, a group who have been deemed a threat to national security, who are being brutally repressed by the Tajik government for no reason beyond their desire for greater autonomy, which is the Pamiri people, which I'm sure we'll dig into in greater detail later in the session. But certainly we've seen Tajikistan using transnational repression, targeting people overseas in Turkey and mostly in Russia. We've had at least 71 cases historically of Tajik citizens in Russia being targeted, in many cases forcibly returned to Tajikistan, and Tajikistan, you know, stands out in a world where we often think of countries, powerful countries like China and Russia, reaching beyond their borders. You know, Tajikistan, a relatively small and weak country. We often don't think of these sort of countries as being able to do this, but Tajikistan certainly has been doing this with increasing frequency in 2022. At least 15 cases, the public cases that we found of individuals being targeted in Russia in 2022 alone, which would be one of the most intense periods we've seen of this sort of practice. So certainly it's a sign that this war on opposition, on journalists, on Pamiris is going global.
Okay, thank you for giving us some perspective on that one too, that it is that bad this year compared to previous years. Salim John, if I could get back to you for just a question, let's go to the trial process of a lot of these people. These trials, or at least many of these trials, seem to be happening in actually the detention facility, right? The CISO, they're closed-door trials. But is that common for Tajikistan to have all these kind of trials in a jail, essentially?
Yeah, that's true. No, usually, according to the law, only those cases that contain state secrets should go behind closed doors. But we are witnessing that, first of all the trials of Badakhshani people who detained either in Badakhshan or in Russian extradited to Tajikistan. And now all the cases of journalists and bloggers are taking place behind closed doors and in the prison itself. And the prison, even we are not, my colleagues in Dushanbe are not able to take picture or to film around up to 20 meters of this facility, because according to the law, so it's filming those facilities are prohibited. So, of course, entering those facilities, even if some relatives are inside or the trial is going on, is not possible. The office of the general prosecutor should give a special permission to whoever wants to enter the facility. And our journalists were not able to enter any of those trials, and even in many cases, even close relatives are deprived to take part on those trials. In some cases, only for a few minutes when the court decision was read, or only just for short time. So, but as a lawyer, Shohrat Khudratov, put it, it's completely illegal, because even when the case contains some national or state secret, there should be a special decision made by the court and confirmed by the Supreme Court. But, you know, there is a lot of procedural shortcomings during those trials.
You know, and let me just ask a follow-up question. Since we know so little about the trial process, do we know what the charges against these people are, and then we find out what they've been found guilty of? But do we have any idea what kind of evidence is being presented at these trials?
Unfortunately, no any solid evidence. Just in the trial of Daleri Imam Ali, yes, there was a situation when he made a report about demolishing some houses around Dushanbe, and some, not all, but some of those houses were built illegally. So, but it's, again, it's not about reporting, it's about the fact. There is no evidences of any of those charges. And in some few minutes, we will publish a letter of Abdusattar Pir Muhammad Zadeh. We obtained it from a source close to the investigation, a source working in the prison, and was asked by Pir Muhammad Zadeh to give this letter to Radio Ozodi. So this is awful letter, and he's telling how the investigators are trying to torturing him to accept those charges, you know, and very heartbreaking letter with the all the evidence that how those people, and this is the example that how those journalists were sentenced, because mostly based on that they agree with the charges. And I can add one more point that we have an information that authorities recorded video confessions of all those journalists. But what's interesting, they still do not publish those videos, probably because they understand that they are full of wrong information, and probably that's why they decided not to publish them so far. But this letter will open a lot of things related to those trials.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. You know, Nick, you cover Central Asia and the Caucasus. What are these trials? What should we learn from these kind of trials? I mean, what's your opinion on this system? You compared with other countries you cover in the Caucasus and Central Asia. Have you seen these kind of incidents where there's closed doors trials? We don't have no idea what the trial process is. We only hear about the charges and the verdict.
Well, of course, Tajikistan has had a very bad press freedom situation for some time. Not as bad as it is at present, but it's always been certainly one of the worst in my region, Central Asia and Caucasus, that I cover. And this region, of course, is one of the worst for press freedom in the world. But something like this we hadn't seen in Tajikistan before, and it really reminds you more perhaps of the situation in Turkmenistan, where it's very, very hard to get any kind of information about any sentences against journalists or activists or others who perhaps you may not even find out about their prison sentences until long after they've occurred. So this situation in Tajikistan is extremely concerning at the moment, and I just want to underline Salim John said that, I mean, really, Tajikistan authorities have done everything possible in these cases to prevent information from becoming public. I mean, as well as holding all of these trials, it appears unlawfully, but behind closed doors. Some of them have been classified as secret. The case against the Pamiri journalists and against Daler Imam Ali, of course. As well as this, they've made the lawyers sign non-disclosure agreements. So the lawyers have generally declined to talk to the media or to international organizations, or else just provided minimal information, and even family members can't get good information about what is happening to their loved ones who are in detention. On top of this as well, there's a real problem at the moment in terms of gathering information about these cases, just because of the fear really that everybody is feeling in Tajikistan at the moment. I mean, some family members of the jail journalists have spoken to us off record, others have declined, but several have said that authorities have, you know, threatened to jail them or to jail other relatives of the journalists, or perhaps to I mean, it's been a serious problem with Tajikistan authorities in collusion with Russia abducting activists, etc., from Russia before, and these threats have been made against these journalists' families as well, with family members in Russia. So, and this is just not just a problem that's affecting family members of the jailed journalists. We're finding that journalists and heads of media outlets in Tajikistan are much less keen to talk to us than before, or they prefer to talk perhaps off record. Even representative advocacy organizations are being very, very cautious with what they're saying. So really, this is an extremely concerning situation in Tajikistan. The people are really very, very scared to speak about anything in detail with these cases, anything that's happening surrounding them.
Okay, thank you. Edward, I want to make sure I have the whole table set here before we try to look into the future and figure out what's going on. You know, in the cases of both the journalists, in the cases of activists from Gorno-Badakhshan region, and even other places, the government seems to have this obsession with connecting them somehow with the opposition in exile, right? That somehow these people are working with the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan or Group 24 or something. Can you talk a little bit about that? About this tendency for the Tajik government, and you know, how credible are any of these topics, or oppositely looking at it, why if it's so hard to believe these connections, does the Tajik government seem so intent on tying up all its loose ends at once, and linking everybody to the opposition in exile?
Right. Well, I think the Tajik government has a long history of, in many ways, inflating and certainly overplaying the threat posed by various opposition movements, terrorist organizations, so-called, extremist organizations in the country. And I think this is part of that broader pattern of overreacting to a threat that is in fact rather minimal. The Islamic Renaissance Party obviously was the opposition movement in the country, the opposition party that held seats in parliament until 2015, but then was rapidly dismantled and labelled a terrorist organisation, Group 24, another opposition movement founded by Umar Ali Govatov, a businessman who fell out with the ruling regime and then fled into exile and founded this opposition movement. And they're both organisations considered to be extremist or terrorist organisations by the government. And so, certainly the government has tried to tie many of the detained journalists, activists to these movements, or made similar accusations of them being part of vaguer terrorist or extremist movements, that are very broadly defined within Tajik legislation. And so this is part of a long-term strategy of trying to use this discourse of terrorism and extremism to discredit legitimate opposition and journalists who are just, as Salim John and Nick have both said, trying to do their job. So it's a way of discrediting them and ultimately, handing down these very long sentences. But certainly it's part of a longer term pattern.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. I think we have all the background information we need to move forward. So, but we are at the midway point in the show. So it's time for me to mention again that this is Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Mejlis podcast, a weekly current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. My name is Bruce Panier. I'm the host of the Mejlis podcast. And today I'm joined by Edward Lemon, president of the Washington-based Oxus Society and research assistant professor at the Bush School of Government and Public Service, Texas A&M University in Washington, D.C. Nick Lewis, Central Asia and Caucasus correspondent at the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Salim John Ayob, and he is the director of RFARL's Tajik service known locally as Azadi. And I thank you all once again for joining me on the program. All right, let's talk about why this is happening this year, because there's certainly, it can't be a coincidence that this is happening, in such a short space of time. As we mentioned at the start, Salim John was talking about that. We can almost put a mark down of November last year when they first had problems in Gorno-Badakhshan, and three people ended up being killed. And ever since then, it seems like it's been nonstop with the Tajik government, some detaining somebody, arresting someone, imprisoning someone. I mean, what is it about 2022 that's different from previous years? To you, Edward, I'm curious, why, your thoughts on why we're seeing all this activity in 2022?
Well, I think, next month signifies the 30th anniversary of when Rahmon was first, during the height of the civil war, elected to the acting position of acting head of state, later was elected in inverted commas president in 1994. But certainly over these 30 years, he's moved from being, a relatively weak and peripheral player within Tajik politics to being the central person in Tajikistan's politics. And I think the crackdown that we've seen and the state repression we've seen in Pamir's is a final process of the consolidation of his power after the civil war. So I think it needs to be viewed within this politics of authoritarian consolidation and stamping out any possibilities of opposition. And I think the crackdowns on journalism are also part of this, final stage of consolidation of power. And I think that is looking towards succession. Obviously, Rahmon turned 70 earlier this month in October 2022, and, has had rumoured to be having some health problems, although it's very difficult to know precisely, given that the crackdown on the media, it's very difficult to get information out of the country, and so we don't really know the accuracy of those claims. But certainly, he is already thinking towards a transition. During the height of the pandemic, his son was elected Speaker of the Upper House of Parliament, which means he would succeed his father should he become incapacitated or die in office. So certainly, there is already in place a potential transition model. And I think as we are looking towards that potential succession, the government and Rahmon's government is looking to fully take control over the country.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Salim John, anything extra you want to add about why is this happening, so much happening in this year all of a sudden?
Yes, as Edward mentioned, there was a plan of power transfer from Mr. Rahman to his son. And apparently the plan is postponing. Some sources in Dushanbe have been telling that it was planned to take place almost a year ago. But as we know, in November, we witnessed Badakhshani events. So, and this is one point. The second point is that it's for many people in Tajikistan, it's coming clear that the government and Mr. Rahmon, after the 30 years of being in office, has not fulfilled his promises. For example, he had been saying that very soon the having not electricity will be a legend, a history, will go to the past. And, but still, even now, today, these days, we have a lot of places in Tajikistan without electricity. And during the winter time, there will be limitation. And also, a lot of other indicators of socioeconomic situation are not as was declared many, many years ago. So, but the main cause or reason it's having there was a command that to make society silent when the power transfer will take place, and those journalists and bloggers and of course those Badakhshani civil activists were among those that will not keep silence when this plan will be implemented. Now, this is one point, and also especially about the journalists. So as it's not started today. As we remember, 2 or 3 years ago, a lot of media outlets were closed down in Tajikistan. Some of them, as they say, voluntarily due to economic reasons, but others, of course, but all of them, as we know, that under huge pressure. And even if you remember, on the eve of Badakhshan events, even the one of the leading independent media holdings, Asia Plus, declared that they will not publish a single sentence about Gorno Badakhshan because they received a threat from the prosecutor general office that if they will publish anything, so they will be shut down. So, Edward also pointed, this started maybe in 2015 when the oppositional Islamic Renaissance Party was blamed as a terrorist and extremist organization, and it was banned in the country, and a lot of members and activists and were detained, and they are serving some of them lifetime prison. Some of them escaped, fled the country, and based in Europe and other countries. So the whole picture a lot of facts telling us that yes, there was a special plan to prepare the Tajik society for the power transfer.
Okay, thank you very much. Nick, I want to get to you with the media, and also we can open up a little bit of discussion on the borders here too, because I want to get that in. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan fought a brief war in 2021, and then they just fought another one last month. You know, now we understand that Tajikistan is an authoritarian government. They want the media to work for them. But we've seen, for example, in Uzbekistan, where they've been able to come to something of a compromise where the media can report on low-level corruption, and it gives people the idea that some officials are getting punished for their misdeeds, but they don't go after the top guys. And in the case of the Kyrgyz-Tajikistan conflicts, Kyrgyzstan, which, as you know, has a much freer media, has done a much better job at reporting on what's been happening there and gotten a lot more sympathy internationally for the fact that they're able to report right away how many people are being evacuated and what the casualties are and what the situation looks like. Whereas Tajik media, still has an arm or both arms tied behind its back and doesn't seem at liberty to report on this. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the Tajik government's manipulation of the media. They should be able to let some media, you would think, act a little more freely just to get a more positive message out of the country, but they don't seem to do that. Why such an insistence on Soviet era style media in Tajikistan?
Yeah, this is a good point, and it's a point that's brought up many times inside Tajikistan as well by journalists there and civil society figures, not just this time, but also when there were border problems of a slightly less severe nature last year. The same point was made, and it's made time and time again by journalists, that this is really the Tajik authorities shooting themselves in the foot, because Kyrgyzstan, with its much freer media sphere, is able to convey its message and to portray the suffering of its people around in border areas in a way that Tajikistan just doesn't do, and it prevents its journalists from doing. So this is really one area that Tajik journalists are really trying to push this argument as much as possible, to say that it's not just a press freedom issue, it's also it's something that's affecting the security and the standing of the country. I think that's a very legitimate point to make.
Great, thank you. And I want to mention two things too. There was a rocket attack that came from Afghanistan earlier in May, actually, that the Islamic State of Khorasan claimed credit for, that the Tajik government did not report on, at least initially. And then I believe, and Selim John can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe they said it was some stray rounds that happened to land in Tajik territory from Afghan territory. So it's been unquiet there. But and I'll ask you this question, Selim John. Is Tajikistan really more stable after all these things that the Tajik government's done domestically? We know that there's extended families in Tajikistan. So every person arrested probably has 20 or 30 relatives who are angry about this right now. Do you get the impression that all these efforts by the government are actually improving domestic stability, or is the opposite true? Are more and more people getting angry and we're getting close to maybe some unrest in the country?
Yes, on the one hand, a lot of people became angry. A lot of people are unhappy about the government. But on the other hand, but the biggest part of those potential protest potential is radicalizing, as was predicted by many experts some years ago. And we are witnessing a lot of sympathy to Taliban, to others, to Daesh, and so on. On the other hand, the border conflict with Kyrgyzstan helped Mr. Rahmon somehow to consolidate his power, to consolidate the society. And as we are witnessing, many people were thinking that after this conflict there, the society will ask a lot of tough questions to the authorities, but it's not happening, And as one of my friend is saying, before that and before his speech, his outburst, ranting Putin in Astana's meeting, now his popularity, unfortunately, there is no weekly or daily sociological research about the popularity of Tajik president or ministers and so on. I remember once we started that, but we faced a lot of problems because the experts were not eager to take part in this kind of poll. So, and one of my friends is saying that before that he was just a president of Tajikistan. Now he became a super president of Tajikistan. Because the system that Mr. Rahmon has been building during all those three decades is giving power only to himself. So just today we discussed with my colleagues about the system, power system in Tajikistan, and he came to the conclusion that now he can even appoint a head of the smallest city of the country, not saying about the judges of all the levels of the jurisdiction level. So he is doing everything himself. At the same time, he is not responsible. He's responsible for nothing. He's not responsible for the situation in the country, for the border conflict, for what happened in Badakhshan. So no one is responsible. So in this kind of situation, the stable country, it's a kind of mirage. We don't know what will happen next. We don't know at what point there will be something that will change everything. So, and those cases of journalists and bloggers, crackdown in Badakhshan and persecution of Badakhshani people, mostly they are bringing negative emotions and negative thoughts even among of some people who are serving this government. That's why it's difficult to predict.
Okay, great. Thank you. And actually, that gives me a great transition into my next point, which is, Edward, I have a question for you. All right, considering the fact that what we've heard that the crackdown is keeping things quiet, but in fact, it's certainly not adding anything to Rahman's popularity. And, you know, in the meantime, he does have external problems as well. That, you know, we mentioned Afghanistan, and we know that there are militants who are actually from Jamaat Ansarullah, which is a movement of mainly citizens of Tajikistan, who are just south of the border, of the Tajik border. And of course, we got this ongoing problem with Kyrgyzstan, which looks like it's ready to erupt again anytime soon. And in fact, Kyrgyzstan just used drones against Tajikistan in the last conflict in September. You know, how precarious is it? I don't want you to make too big of a prediction, but how precarious is the Tajik government situation? I mean, they have a deteriorating situation domestically. They're more unpopular. They might have got some popularity, as Salim John mentioned, from the conflict with Kyrgyzstan. But even that, you know, if another one breaks out, evidence would suggest there'll be more casualties and damage the next time around than there was even this last time. How precarious is the situation for the Tajik government at this moment, especially when they're planning on doing this transfer of power from father to son?
Sure, I think it's a very challenging time, and I think that's one of the reasons, as Salim John mentioned, that we've seen this transition succession being delayed. You know, we talked about it maybe happening in 2020 with the elections scheduled for that year, and that didn't happen perhaps because of COVID, and then obviously we've had all these other crises that have broken out as we've been discussing. And so I think, you know, certainly Afghanistan is a challenge, as we do have Jamaat Ansarullah, which controls some of that border. You know, it's founded by a warlord from Tajikistan who didn't accept the peace deal of 1997. Amruddin Tabarov subsequently died, but you know, the leadership of that organization still has connections within the country, and most of, you know, many of the members are originally hailing from Tajikistan or descended from people who are hailing from Tajikistan. So certainly that's a threat. I would say that the border situation with Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan's, you know, the militarization of that conflict, as you've discussed on the Matchleys podcast, and the sort of deployment of heavy weapons, mortars, drones, artillery, et cetera, and the shelling of areas in Kyrgyzstan, for example, like downtown Batken, you know, really signifies a massive escalation. And I think those problems are not going away. And I think, you know, looking at reporting from people like Aseldulat Geldeva, who was just in Batken, you know, indicates that people, you know, certainly on the Kyrgyz side of the border are preparing for more violence and conflict. And I think that's, you know, that's going to be a major challenge for not only Tajikistan, but the region as a whole. I think succession itself is also going to be potentially destabilizing. You know, we have this succession plan to give power to Rustam, the president's son, but the president has 9 children and various other members of his extended family, not all of whom are completely aligned with Rustam. And beyond that, we have people like Yatimov, the head of the security services, who's known to not have the best relationships with Rustam. So I think certainly there are different factions, you know, different groups within the presidential family that Tajik, you know, President Rahman has managed to keep a lid on those conflicts for the most part. But I feel like as he as succession takes place, it's going to open the opportunities for many of these groups within the presidential family, within the ruling elite, to potentially get into conflict with one another. And that could also be destabilizing.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, Nick, I want to get in some last comments from you about the media situation, especially you've been listening to the conversation going forward. I mean, how much does it handicap people in the country and people outside the country that, you know, we've been talking about all these events that are going on? You know, am I wrong in saying the Tajik media just doesn't get the message out that would help it to get more outside aid, sympathy, something like that? I know you kind of covered that with the Kyrgyz conflict, but I mean more broadly.
Yeah, I think it's certainly an issue, particularly with the conflict with Kyrgyzstan. But I mean, just across the board, it seems like the Tajik authorities are just stuck in this mindset where they want to make sure that as little information as possible about the country gets out. I mean, we saw this with the Badakhshan events in May. They kind of immediately enforced basically an information blockade on Badakhshan. They cut the internet, telecommunications as well, across lots of the region for well over a month. The internet was down. And of course, that happened, you know, for about 4 months after they had the problems there in November as well. I mean, they did things like put roadblocks in place, prevented journalists from going to Badakhshan to report on the issues. And then, of course, the threats against Asia Plus, which were mentioned by Salim Jan earlier, threatening to close them down because of their allegedly one-sided coverage of events in Badakhshan. Another thing we can mention was the attack on four RFERL and Current Time TV journalists who were reporting from Dushanbe, interviewing Mohammad Shoaib about events in Badakhshan. And I mean, those journalists have said they believe this was done by, it was done in a very professional way that suggests it was done by Tajik authorities, you know, the, by law enforcement themselves. And Azad have been under intense, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service, Radio Azadi, have been under intense pressure since then. So because of all this, I mean, this has caused a huge amount of self-censorship in Tajikistan, particularly on Badakhshan issues. And really, what we've seen is that, I mean, Azadi has done a fantastic job. They've been really the main source for information, not just about Badakhshan, but other critical topics as well, alongside some of these exile-based outlets, European-based like Bondad or Payam, or some independent journalists like Anwar Sakharov, who's done a fantastic job covering these topics. So it's been, I mean, it's very concerning going forward, like how media society and how outlets in Tajikistan are going to be able to continue covering topics that matter, not just, you know, not just in terms of for an international audience, but also, you know, to fulfill the demands and the needs of Tajik citizens themselves for information about what's going on in their society.
Okay, thank you very much. And we're coming to the end of the program. But I want, and I mean, we've discussed a lot, but there's obviously a lot more we probably could discuss on this topic, what's happening in Tajikistan. Is there anything I left out and someone wants to make a last comment? The floor is open. Going once, going twice. Okay, third time. Then I'll say that we've covered all that we can for 45 minutes, which is a lot. So I want to give a big thank you to Nick and Salim Jan and Edward for being on the program today and helping me to discuss the situation in Tajikistan. Of course, a huge thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's website at rferl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.